My heart has no words. My eyes have no tears left. Mind had done gone crazy. Went off and married my fears. Now I'm standing here with nothing left to tell you. I'm standing here with nothing to prove. I got nothing to prove.
All right, welcome to another episode of Mormon Expression Voices. I will be your host this evening. My name is Greg, and I have with me Sean and Stacy Levitt. Sean and Stacy, thanks for coming on.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us. We're excited.
We're excited too. Sean and Stacy, just to give sort of the quick background for me, their home was the first post-Mormon home that we were invited into, and met them and a bunch of good friends, and had, I guess that Letty and I will be pretty much forever grateful for your guys' hospitality and for giving us a nice place to land when we definitely needed it, and for you and a lot of other nice people modeling happy post-Mormon relationships, that was a big deal. I've told you guys that before, and that we think about that a lot. So happy to have you on and to hear your story and talk about kind of your journey in and through and potentially out of Mormonism. We don't want to give away the ending, but... Spoiler alert. So, but let's start. You guys were high school sweethearts. So let's go back and kind of talk about how did you meet and, how did that happen?
Short and sweet. The Reader's Digest version, we met in the Jell-O aisle.
Let's have the longer version.
I love telling people that because I love the expression they get on their face when I tell them we met in the Jell-O aisle, especially in Utah. No, we met the end of my junior year in high school, the end of Stacy's senior year in high school. And, okay, how far back to go? I had been dating another girl for a few months, and she went home for the summer. I was dating a BYU freshman at that point, and she went home for the summer, and I was very depressed, and a friend of mine... was working at Storehouse Market, which was a grocery store that's a few blocks from my house. And I went down there to buy caffeine and chocolate to drown my sorrows in. And she said, "You need to come back just before we close and we can hang out. My boss is cool. Well, you know, he'll let you hang out and we can talk after." She's a really good friend of mine. And I ended up staying there until about 5 a.m. because they were inventorying the Jell-O aisle. They had to take everything down off the top of the shelves, count it, put it back up. And so I was just helping them out because I needed something to do and distract myself with. So I was up on one end of the stacks, passing stuff down, and there was a girl down on the other end of the stacks, and... We ended up passing notes written on Karo syrup labels that we were tearing off the bottles.
I wasn't tearing any of them off. The ones I found were already off.
Okay. So another girl that was working there was playing messenger girl and running these notes back and forth. And I happened to be working the same schedule. And so I would go over and then a bunch of us would go over to Hardee's after work and we'd hang out and... I've tried to remember how long it was, but it was maybe a couple of months, maybe not even that long.
Yeah, I don't think it was that long.
Maybe a month, I don't know. But we just clicked. I mean, right, that first night, we just clicked. And then, you know, just hanging out every night, and then we just started to date. And we were doing stuff at least... twice, three times a week, every week.
Yeah, your mom would only let you date once a week, but you'd come over and make cookies and
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah, so. We couldn't go out, but I could go over to her house, and we'd watch movies or whatever. So we dated for 2 years, and I had the ever-looming cliff of my mission looming ever closer. And so that was difficult, but we wanted to get in as much time together before I left as possible.
Stacey, how did you feel about the ever-looming cliff?
It's just what you did. That's what everybody did. They went on their missions, and so it was just inevitable. I knew it was coming, and I was trying to help push him towards that because I figured that would help make him a better person, because that's what I was taught, and, you know, that's just what everybody does.
Sure.
If you're a good little Mormon boy in Utah Valley, you'd go on a mission. There's just no question.
So you were a good little Mormon boy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I walked the path, you know. Baptized at 8. I was, you know, priesthood at 12. Mm. I went to a private school. I wasn't a troublemaker. I don't know. It just never even crossed my mind to. I had a couple of kids that I hung out with periodically who I would have defined as troublemakers, but I mean, you're talking about that it's relative. Troublemaker in Utah Valley is, he swears.
My, how times have changed. Stacey, what about you? Were you the good little Mormon girl?
Yes and no. I mean, I followed all the rules, but I never quite fit into the molds because I don't like authority. I always had a problem with these men trying to tell me what to do. I had issues with that. So I was always questioning when I probably shouldn't have been, but I don't think I'd be where I am now if I didn't.
And did you grow up in Orem too?
I grew up in Vernal and moved to Orem when I was 15.
How was Vernal?
So interesting. It's backwards. A lot of the stuff that I learned in, as far as the gospel goes, I learned all the true history. I knew about all of Joseph Smith's wives and, you know, all of that stuff. My stake president had a vision at one point that the world was going to end just before my 16th birthday, that would be the second coming, and that, so I really didn't expect to live past 16. So when 16 came and 17, and now I'm a little far past that, but I was surprised to hit that mark.
So you were seriously surprised about that. You thought, well, the stake president had this vision and,
oh yeah,
so it must be right.
Absolutely. I had no plans. I had no life plans at all. I didn't plan on college, nothing. I just thought, you know, what's the point? Because it wasn't going to happen.
And so when the inevitable end did not come, how did that affect your thinking about the church and about, like, you know, your about priesthood and revelation and stuff?
Well, when that didn't happen, I moved to, like, so we moved to Orem just before I turned 16. And so I was talking to my church leaders there and said, well, this is what I was taught. And they're like, oh, no, that's all lies. And so they went back to the sanitized version that everybody's taught now. And so I put it kind of in the back of my mind because I figured, well, maybe it's just a bunch of crazy old people out there that didn't know what they were talking about. But at that point, I didn't get along with a lot of the people that I moved, you know, in the neighborhood that I moved in with. So I just kind of quit going to church at that point until I met Sean and started going back to church again because I needed to make sure he got on his mission. And
well, and she needed to be the good little Mormon girl that gets paired up with the good little Mormon boy.
Yeah.
You know, that's what you do in Utah Valley. You follow the plan and you follow the path, and good little Mormon boys get together with good little Mormon girls, and they get, you know, and they get married and they have good little Mormon children, and they continue the cycle.
And so you went on your mission and you dutifully supported him. You guys made it, you apparently made it through high school without without deviating too much from the good little Mormon path, because you went on your mission.
I went on my mission, yeah.
Either by hook or by crook.
Yeah, I won't say that there weren't times when I wished things were different. So one of the things that I've learned about in the last couple of years is the idea of natural progression of a relationship between two humans, and at some point in that relationship, it's going to become physical just by the natural progression of relationships, just because that's the way we're built, so that we will reproduce and have kids and continue the species. And part of the issue that crops up in more dogmatic, restrictive religions is that at some point that natural progression gets stunted or halted, so to speak. And that's what we were running into, because we dated for 2 years before I left on my mission. And that's a pretty long time by anybody's relationship standards. And so we were running into that, constantly. It's this natural urge to take things farther that's competing with this idea that, no, I have to be a good little Mormon boy. And if I don't, then I don't go on my mission. And I got to deal with all this social stigma and ostracization and all this stuff that, and so that there was always that tension. I don't know if you want to address that from your perspective at all.
Well, I mean, the church put so much pressure on women and girls to make sure that, the girls know they're responsible not only for themselves, but whatever guys they're with. That, they're the ones that have to keep the guys on the straight and narrow. They're the ones that are ultimately responsible. And to put a little more of a creepy factor on it, I actually had a bishop tell me once that not only is it, your ancestors that are watching you up in heaven, but your children-to-be are up in heaven watching you. So you want to make sure that, you're not doing anything that you shouldn't be doing to scar those spirits before they come down.
Did he actually use, that kind of phrasing,
yes.
Scar those spirits, those poor little eyes? Like, if you wouldn't do this in front of your children eventually, then you need to make sure that you're not doing it now because they're watching.
Right, yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's a unique twist on sort of twisted.
Well, and then to take it to another level, you talk to people who have leadership who tell them that if you screw up badly enough, your children that you're supposed to have won't be able to come to you because you won't be worthy anymore. Which gets into a whole weird level of Saturday's Warrior kind of folklore-y kind of doctrine.
That's, I was just thinking folk doctrine. Like, there's been a lot of talk about folk doctrine recently, right? Mm-hmm. About legitimate, total true doctrines. not true, but legitimate doctrines. But yeah, like, there's this sort of willingness. There's something in our Mormon DNA that is a willingness to just say stupid stuff and call it God's truth and be like really serious about it. That's really funny. And isn't it weird from a different perspective now? Because I'll bet you both took it really seriously. Did you go like,
oh yeah,
crap?
I never got that. My leadership tended to be a little more sane on the whole than some of the ones that she ended up with. I don't know that maybe is just a symptom of the way they routine the young women versus what they put the young men through. Because, Stacy can obviously speak more to this than I can, but the impression that I get as far as the young women are concerned is that they get routine more along the lines of, you need to make sure that the young man that you're dating stays worthy. It's up to you to make sure that he controls himself so that you can get married in the temple and have children. And from the guy's perspective, it's more stop playing with yourself all the time. And that's basically all we get. So I don't remember hearing a whole lot of you need to not mess around with your girlfriend or it's going to offend your potential children or your ancestors who've passed on or anything like that. I don't remember ever hearing that.
Yeah, I did. I took it very, very seriously.
And I think maybe if I had, I don't know that I would have been able to stop myself from laughing just because on the surface it's sort of absurd. And it's just become more so now that I have a different perspective on the whole thing.
That's the thing about the absurdity, isn't it? That, like, things that are patently absurd that we see now were very, very serious.
Oh, it made total sense to me then.
Yeah.
Absolute sense. I bought it hook, line, and sinker. I mean, that was what I was living my life by. And, you know, making all my decisions by.
I think I almost feel like I want to underline this because you made an interesting point, Sean, and I kind of want to make sure that this is what you're saying, and that women are, that girls are assigned to be sort of the caretaker of the relational purity, like the purity between the two. That's the girl's responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely.
As Sean so eloquently says, boys are really just expected to stop playing with themselves. Maybe we sort of assume, well, we can't expect all that much. One of the things that the church does really quite frequently in a kind of a folk doctriney way is to denigrate whatever responsibility men have. It's kind of like in conjunction with a larger societal trend to say, like, men are just kind of buffoons.
Yeah. And then you can't possibly expect them to take any sort of responsibility. Yes,
but, do anything.
But they're the
yeah.
ones that have the priesthood. And so even though they treat the men and say the men are basically buffoons, they're over the women, which
right. well,
really
then,
limits the way that women are looked at,
sure.
too. I mean, it treats them even
but,
makes
you know,
them look even lower.
One of the
yeah.
apologetic responses for why women don't have the priesthood is because men are such buffoons, they need the priesthood to help them.
Yeah.
That
line of reasoning was always deeply offensive to me for, like,
yeah.
in my most faithfulness. I thought, not that I thought, no, you know, men are so much more. I just thought this whole concept of this comparative thing is just lame. But so you headed out into the mission field. You,
yes.
As a good little Mormon boy, you went to the temple first. Anything notable at the temple?
The temple. Yes, the temple. My first experience at the temple is ingrained in my memory beyond all hope of erasing it. Because I thought it would be a good idea, heaven only knows why at this point, I thought it would be a good idea to go to a live session my first time through. And that is a trip. If you've never done that and you still have the chance, it's a trip. So We packed up the car and went all the way down to Manti. Yeah. I don't remember why. I think I just liked the way it looked. I thought the building was prettier or something. I'm not really sure at this point. It's been too long. But anyway, first time through the temple, my two most... I hate to use the term scarring because it's such a loaded word. The two moments that stick out the most to me were when I went through the washing and anointing for the first time and the prayer circle, because they were so deeply weird to me. I had no context for what was happening, and I don't know how much you want to get into details. I don't know how much.
Why don't we talk about what's relevant?
Washing and anointing. I mean, obviously, you know, most of the people that are listening to this are going to know that they've changed that recently. But there's some fairly intimate touching that goes on during the washing and anointing, and I was not prepared for that at all. I wasn't aware that I was only going to be wearing a sheet with nothing on underneath it. Nobody had told me that. And nobody had told me anything about what was going to go on with that. And my dad, who was my escort, was nowhere to be found at that point. I'm not really sure, even to this day, where he went. And so it was very traumatic for me to go through that by myself and just be really confused and scared. And I just remember thinking, this is not the church that I grew up with. This is nothing like anything I've experienced so far. And then, you know, you go into the endowment and it's just foreign to everything, but everybody around you is smiling. And, you know, you got your family there, and I was going to go on my mission in a couple of days. And so you just go through it. And you know, it was like most of my life in the church, this is what you do. And everybody around you seems okay with it. So it must be something with me. It must be some sort of shortcoming on my part that I don't understand why this is the way it is. And then my mom insisted that I needed to take part in the prayer circle the first time, because that was just amazing. It was so neat. That was the way she referred to it. And I remember standing there, and I remember, I don't know that the word cult-like, to calling it Johnism, went through my head at that point, but it was very strange. I mean, to stand there and to be repeating a prayer rote, clothed the way we were and standing in a circle and doing what we were doing, it was just, it was like something out of a movie. And just didn't jive with what I knew the church to be. But again, it's not like I could back out at that point. My family's all standing on either side of me, and I've got my mission in a couple of days, and I just, there's really no choice at that point.
You know, I want to say something really quick that, you know, the audience is a pretty knowing audience, right? So most people, as you say, are going to, they know what you're talking about, and they have their own experience that they're thinking about it with. Mm. And there will be a lot of people who are listening and going, well, that's not the experience that I had.
Sure.
It's a fairly typical thing, right? They'll say, well, I didn't feel freaked out, or nobody touched me inappropriately, or I didn't, whatever. And I guess I want to say the important thing is not to establish, we do that naturally. We have a tendency to look at the experience of somebody else versus our own experience and try to sort of make sense of things from that. And the important thing here is not to figure out whether this is in alignment with everyone else's experience, whether everyone else's experience is the same, whether they all feel the same things, whether they all had the same level of preparation. But the important thing is to understand that that was your experience.
Yes.
And to see that, and to understand that, that in some way that experience can happen that way, you know, and that maybe it doesn't always, maybe it doesn't even most of the time, maybe a lot of the time, you know, people have better preparation or whatever, but
then again, that's really kind of the point, because you go through the temple and you're not allowed to talk about it with anybody else. And so how do you know whether anybody else has had a similar traumatic experience? Because you can't ask them. You don't, that's not something you would talk about with anybody. I mean, we didn't talk to each other about the way we felt about the temple until after we'd gone through some, you know, some serious events.
Yeah.
And just because it's so taboo. And again, I agree completely with your point that, you know, I would certainly not attempt to say that this is everybody's or even most people's experience with the temple. But I will say that I have talked to a number of people in the last several years who have felt pretty much the same way.
Oh, yeah. So have I.
Not necessarily about the same aspects or the same events in the temple. Different things weird different people in different ways.
Sure.
So I think the biggest issue with it is that there is so little in the way of actual informed preparation.
Well, even the temple prep classes have nothing to do with what goes on in the temple.
Yeah,
for just want to make sure you're, you know, paying your tithing and attending your meetings and all of that stuff. So even what they call temple prep isn't.
So do you want to talk about her temple experience? Because that was after my mission. Or do you want to talk mission first?
Yeah, let's talk about your first temple experience, Stacey, and then we'll kind of skip back a little bit to the mission.
Okay. When I went to the temple, the first time was Provo Temple, and that's when I took my endowments out. It was a few days before our wedding, and my mother wasn't a member, and so I had my mother-in-law as my escort. She disappeared on me, too, so I don't know if that's normal course or just how things happen, but honestly, it was such a blur to me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like that the men and women were separated. That really bothered me. So I did have that. And, you know, I tried so hard. I ended up with such a headache just trying to concentrate on trying to find meaning in the temple movie and all that stuff that I ended up kind of making myself sick over it. And then we ended up getting married in Manti a few days later. We drove down to Manti. And that was kind of weird because I forgot my wallet and needed to rent some temple clothes. And I had the thought at that point, wasn't this one of the things that Jesus got upset about, money changing in the temple? But I was paying for, you know, to rent clothing in the temple. So I don't know. Just that day was kind of a blur too.
That was a big blur.
It's
you know, another aspect of the temple that was troubling was how impersonal the wedding seemed to be. You know, we're being married by somebody that we've never met before who wants to give us advice. But we're not actually making promises to each other. We're dressed in strange clothing in a room full of people that are dressed in their church clothes, and it's uncomfortable, but we're really not concentrating on any of that because we just want to be married and get out of there. And
yeah, well, he did tell me to bake bread a lot. I'm gluten intolerant, so it was kind of doesn't quite work so well, but you know.
Less than prophetic advice.
So let's go back. We'll pick up back again with that. But let's hear about the mission. You went to Germany?
I did. I went to the Frankfurt mission in Germany. I was there from 90 to 92, and it was a long couple of years because I had a girl waiting for me, and that seems to make it take longer.
Maybe so.
And I watched, you know, companion after companion get Dear John letters. Some of them got them in the MTC, which seemed kind of brutal. The MTC, that was... talk about a pressure cooker. I had a hard time with that. And I'd already had 7 years of German at that point. But that was difficult for me. I'm like Stacy, I have an issue with authority, and the MTC is just nothing but stratified authority. And sitting in class for 10 hours a day and not having any real outlets. And I mean, I won't say that we didn't have some good times, because there were some really good guys in my district, and we had fun and we worked. But 9 weeks in a pressure cooker of conformity and obedience was very difficult for me. And then I got to Germany and spent 2 years in a futile attempt to convert a country which is hopelessly secular, even in 1990. The people there that are religious, okay, so I'd be a rich man if I had a nickel for every time I heard the phrase, I was born Catholic, I was raised Catholic, and I'm going to die Catholic. Or insert Protestant, depending on the geographic location that you happen to be. Because Germany is very stratified as far as, you know, okay, this geographical area is Catholic and this geographical area is Protestant. And it's very easy for them to do that because it doesn't really require anything from them. Most people will go to church maybe a couple of times a year until they get old and they're trying to work their way back into heaven, and then they'll start going to church every day. But for most people, church has no significance in their life, and they're fine with that. They get along just great without it. And even in 1990, they knew far too much about the Mormon church that they knew they didn't want to have anything to do with it. So I spent 10 hours a day for 2 years knocking on doors. I was lucky that I didn't get dogs sicked on me or guns pointed at me like some of the guys I knew. But it was definitely an exercise in patience.
Did you baptize anybody on your mission?
That was one of the first issues that I had. One of my first red flags, if you want to start marking red flags. I baptized one German in 2 years. I baptized an American who was married to a Mormon girl who's a military guy, and I think he was just trying to keep the peace. The majority of the people that I baptized were African refugees, and we baptized a lot of them, and it bothered me a lot.
Why?
Because I always felt like they were being used for numbers. In all fairness, they probably, to a certain extent, were using the baptism to try to get to America. Because without exception, they viewed the Mormon church as an American institution. And so they figured if they could get in good with the Mormons, then maybe the Mormons would help them get to America and they could have a better life once they got there. So I guess in a way it was kind of a mutual parasitic relationship. But I always was bothered by the fact that we were using these guys to shore up our numbers. That's the only reason we had any significant numbers of baptisms in every month. And it didn't seem to bother anybody else. And it bothered me that it didn't seem to bother anybody else.
Hmm.
Of course, it may have. They may have just been keeping quiet like I was, trying not to cause waves. But I was never proud of what we did. Because none of them were converted. None of them ever came to church after they were baptized because there wasn't anywhere for them to go to church. All the churches were German. I mean, there were very few American branches scattered here and there, mostly in towns with bases. So that was a tough thing for me to try to make work in my head. The other big red flag for me was that was the first time that I was forced to come head to head with the idea of ladder climbing as far as leadership positions. There were guys in the MTC who were making bets as to who would get to be AP first. There were guys whose entire waking life was devoted to the idea of getting ever more responsibility and ever higher leadership callings. And those were the guys that got the callings. And without exception, in my humble opinion, they were the ones that were the least suited to do that sort of thing. But they were the bootlickers, the apple polishers, and they were the ones that got noticed, and they were the ones that got promoted. And I will use that word without hesitation. And they looked at it the same way. They were being promoted up the chain of command. And so that was hard for me to deal with too. And that was the first inkling that I started to see that the guys in the upper leadership positions, they were just trying to muddle through this the same way as anybody else. They didn't have any more inspiration or revelation or special experiences than anybody else did. And that continued to get worse after I got home and started, you know, getting into home wards and was actually in leadership callings and stuff. And it was just like, wait a minute, where's the special guidance that I'm supposed to have to tell me what I'm supposed to do here? I'm just kind of dangling on the end of a string here.
Huh. What leadership callings did the two of you have? What kinds of callings did you serve in?
I was in various elders quorum presidencies, scouting callings, which I guess could be argued doesn't necessarily need a whole lot in the way of revelation, but various
activities committees.
Yeah, activities like committees and clerk callings. Yeah. And
I was in the primary presidency and the Relief Society presidency at different times. We were in nursery forever. We had small kids.
Yeah.
That nursery was my favorite. Such a manifestation of revelation. Yes. You've got small kids, so you must want to be in nursery.
Although, to be fair, nursery was always my favorite.
You calling. Liked it.
I love nursery.
Man.
You go in and play with toys for 2 hours, you get snacks.
I would rather gouge my eyeballs out.
Wow, I had a blast. I love playing with the little kids. We just had fun. I didn't have to worry about teaching lessons.
Well, until they started pushing the lessons. They did start pushing the lessons where you're supposed to start teaching the Articles of Faith. And so we were supposed to start having lessons at that point and got a little harder.
I got called. The last calling I ever got was as an elders quorum instructor. And that almost broke me. And I'm skipping ahead quite a bit. But I was having some severe issues at that point, and that just made them a lot worse.
So let's go back to that. Let's go back to sort of the cracks, because you're both sort of talking about how you had concerns and bad experiences, but you didn't get married and take off your garments and leave the church right away.
No. No. I mean, I came home from my mission. I served honorably. I completed my entire mission. And I, for the most part, at that point, I think I felt pretty good about it. And I suspect some of that may come from having accomplished it. Because, you know, when you grow up around here, that's the goal. That's the one that you shoot for when you're a kid going on a mission. And so having accomplished that was pretty big. So I get home, and we had written each other every week. Mm-hmm. I even missed my family a couple of weeks, but I didn't miss her a single week. Got home. We started right up where we left off, dating all the time. We just fell right back in. We clicked immediately again, and we got engaged 6 weeks after I got home, and we were married 4 months and 3 days after I got home. So real quick, because that's what you do. You get home from your mission and you get married. And yeah, I mean, like you said, there weren't any significant cracks at that point. That's what you do. You come home and you get married and you go to church. And our daughter was born just over 2 years after we got married. Like you're supposed to do, because you're supposed to have kids.
Well, one of the things women are taught, too, is once you get married, you get the fairy tale. You know, you live happily ever after, as long as you have a priesthood holder that's worthy. And, you know, I think that's why there's so many people that get disillusioned, and there's so many antidepressants being used in the state, is because they realize that it's real life. It's not just the fairy tale anymore.
I don't even know if they realize it. It just is real life. It's not a fairy tale. Yeah. Well, whether they're aware of that or not, it just is the case.
Well, but then, I mean, if there's such a thing as a Mormon fairy tale, we were kind of living it. We lived in Utah Valley. We were going to BYU. I mean, I spent a year at BYU before I went on my mission, and I came home and I went back to BYU, and we were living in BYU married student housing, and we were going to BYU, and we were going to BYU Ward, and you know, that's the Mormon fairy tale, right?
Was it awesome?
Oh, no.
Awesome. I don't.
I wouldn't define it as awesome.
No, my experience at BYU was less than awesome.
Yeah.
That was another red flag, frankly. Finding out the number, the amount of politics and favoritism that goes on at what is supposed to be the Lord's University really bothered me. And that's, I ended up leaving BYU before I got my degree because of that. I was really disillusioned with what happened down there. And I'm not the first person to say that. I've heard lots of people say that. But, you know, I mean, we were too wrapped up in each other to really be bothered by that to a great degree. We were living our lives. We were married. I mean, this is what we've been working for forever. Yeah. You know, we dated for 2 years and then I was gone for 2 years. And now we're finally married. Holy crap. And you know, our fairy tale has come true. I didn't get Dear Johned and all that kind of stuff. So we just kind of fell into, you know, continuing along that path that's laid out for you. Going to church every week, taking callings, having kids, paying bills.
Paying tithing.
That was one of them. That was another another crack that eventually got worse and worse. We both eventually developed a testimony of not paying tithing because everything seemed to go to hell every time we did. I mean, you're supposed to get blessed for paying tithing, and it seemed like we just got boned every time we did.
Yeah.
I mean, her dad that I've only met once and she hadn't seen in 20 years shows up and threatens to sue us over inheritance. You know, I mean, and that was just one. But, you know, I mean, you know, we trekked the path.
So what were the first cracks? What were the things? Because you talk about this, yes. And yet I'm still saying, like, was it some dawning realization of, like, or did you have, like, a thing?
No. Well, I guess it depends on your definition of thing. I had lots of little things that went on my shelf, just like everybody else.
Sure.
Lots of little cracks, lots of little issues.
Well, if you look at them one at a time, it's easy to just write them off. It's not that big of a deal, whatever. But when you have, you know, 30 or 100 of them, it adds up in a big hurry and you can't ignore them anymore.
There was a guy, and I wish I could go back and talk to him again, but he would bring things up in Elders Quorum that made me squirm. Really uncomfortable topics. And unfortunately, I can't name anything, but I'm sure it was a lot of this uncorrelated stuff that nobody talks about anymore. And he would just ask questions because he was one of those guys that liked messing with people. And it really made me uncomfortable because that I didn't want to think about it. But I got to the point where I was having to think about it, and I got to the point where I was sitting in church, looking around me, going, this isn't working for me anymore.
You know, he actually made the comment at one point that he kind of felt like a stranger, you know, in a strange land, sitting here just watching everybody.
I was becoming more emotionally disconnected from it because it wasn't working for me.
Prop 8 was one of our big...
Prop 8 was my last
one. That's big, yeah.
If you want to talk about the one thing, that was my last one thing. And that was the big one. Because it was so wrong to me. You know, I'm not going to speak for other people. But to me, it was so... I couldn't reconcile it. I couldn't make it work in my head. That we were being instructed to go and take away rights of other citizens, other people. We were supposed to go and force them to do the right thing according to what we thought, which just ran completely counter to everything that I felt was right and everything that I felt that I'd been taught my entire right. life growing up.
Well, the Articles of Faith even say that, you know, we're supposed to let everybody believe what they want to believe and, you know, worship the way they want to and live the way they want to.
It just seemed... It smacked more of what the devil's plan was supposed to have been for us. He was going to make everybody do the right thing. And that just seemed like what we were trying to do, is make everybody do the right thing. And so it started out, I mean, when the whole thing first started to gain traction and wind up, it bothered me on probably a mostly unconscious level, but it got to the point where it was rubbing against my grain so much that I was forced to deal with it. And at that point, there was almost an audible snap in my head, and I just couldn't make myself emotionally connect anymore with what was going on around me.
Was it visible to other people?
No. Mm-mm. No, I mean...
Was it visible to Stacy?
Well, yeah, because we talked about it a little bit. And, I mean, we've been together for so long. You know, it's pretty easy to read him, but...
If there was any outward sign of my issues, my discontent, it was the fact that I spent pretty much the entire three-hour block staring at my phone, you know, either my Palm Pilot at, you know, in the early stages, or I had an iPhone in the later stages. And the only way I could keep myself sane was to read.
Did you know that that was the only way you could keep yourself sane? Were you aware of it?
At first, no, I really wasn't. But it got to the point where I realized what I was doing, and I realized why I was doing it. And Stacy would give me crap. About every couple of months, she'd come down on me for reading in church.
So, Stacy, you were the faithful wife?
Well, that's what I was supposed to do.
Yep.
I was supposed to keep him and the kids on track, and it was all my responsibility to make sure everybody was doing what they were supposed to. I would actually make myself physically sick stressing about it and trying to get everybody in line.
Why would you stress so much?
Because it was my responsibility. If the kids were acting up, if he wasn't doing what he was supposed to, then I wasn't doing my part. So I was taking it all on myself.
Was it like your responsibility because socially it was your responsibility? How much did you sort of internalize the danger of eternity and like the eternal consequences of this kind of stuff?
It was mostly the eternal consequences.
Did you think about, what are you doing? This is our eternal family.
A little bit. I mean, not in that way quite so much, but it was trying to get the kids to the point that they could have their eternal families. And that, you know, once they had their own spouses, they were on their own. But trying to make sure that he was going to be there, and I was going to drag him along for it if I had to.
Had you ever thought that you would have to drag him along before? Was that kind of a pattern in your marriage, or
no.
Or was that like a new thing?
It was a church thing.
Yeah.
That was
How do
it.
You mean?
Well, I mean, I guess maybe I misunderstood the question, but the only aspect of our lives where, and I realized that she was having to do this was in, as far as religion and church was concerned. I'm not somebody that needs to be dragged unless it's something that I really have an issue with.
She wasn't like having to kick you out of bed to go to work
no,
in the morning.
No, or school or any of that stuff. So it was all just church. And
well, and he would play this game on Sunday mornings where if he didn't wake me up, would be late. So I might not go.
I'd wake up on time to get to church, and then I'd lay there and pretend to be asleep. I was trying to fool myself as much as I was trying to fool her. Because if I slept in long enough, then, oh, we're too late, and let's not worry about it today. Mm. It's just the games that you play with yourself to try to keep it together. Mm. So she would bug me about reading in church. And I honestly felt bad about it. Sincerely, I did. Because
I was mostly jealous because I didn't think I could get away with it.
You know, on a number of levels, I felt bad about doing it because this isn't what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to go to church and be edified and uplifted, and you're supposed to get all these wonderful messages from Sunday school, and I just wasn't getting it. It was like going to the temple, frankly. Every time I went to the temple, this is the time. This is, I'm going to get something. This time, I'm going to pray, and I'm going to fast, and I'm going to go, and I'm going to really concentrate, and I'm going to, this learning, this thing, everybody says, every time I go to the temple, I learn something new. I didn't. Mm. And obviously, that's something with me, right? Church was the same way. I never got what I was supposed to be getting at church. All I got was tired, because you get up and you got to fight with your kids to get ready. And so everybody's tired and grumpy by the time they get to church. And church seemed to be nothing but drudgery because you're listening to the same thing that you've heard a million times before.
And it's a dumbed down version now than what it was.
It's dumbed down. And on top of the drudgery is a bunch of guilt. And I'm adding to my own guilt because in order to deal with the drudgery, I'm reading something besides church stuff. And so I'm piling my own guilt on top of the guilt that I'm getting from the lesson that is telling me about all these things that I should be doing in order to be a good person that I'm not doing because I can't take the assigned friendship visit every month anymore and stuff like that. And so she would get on me for reading and then I would stop. Because I felt bad, and I felt bad that she felt like she had to browbeat me into stopping because that was, you know, you're supposed to be a good person, and this is not being a good person. And then it would get to be too much again, and so I would start again, and just to keep my own sanity. So, wow, we really got derailed from your question. You asked the original question, were there any outward signs that anybody would notice that I was having issues. And that was the only outward sign. But if you look at an average elders quorum on an average Sunday, 99% of the people in there are staring at their phones because they can't take it either. They're bored to death. And they're using their phones for the same thing I was using mine for, just to get by.
It's funny. That's, you know, you spend any amount of time in a more liberal congregation, like say the Unitarians, and we've gone there a fair amount lately, and no one has. It's like nobody is there except because they want to be. Yeah. So there, no phones are out. That would be actually, you know, it'd be like, well, what do you just stay home then?
Yeah, why are you here?
Yeah. So it's kind of a funny thing because for sure, you know. Electronic devices have taken over the ward meeting houses.
Yeah.
So what was the snapping point? What was that?
Talk about the exit part of it. Do you want me to start?
Well, I think that's what he was asking, is what was the snapping point? Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, it kind of started with a crossword puzzle. Sean would do crossword puzzles all the time, and every once in a while, if he couldn't find an answer, he'd go online to cheat, try to search it. And so he was looking up an acronym for NOM, N-O-M. And on the wiki pages that came up, one of the things that came up was New Order Mormon. So he spent 3 days reading everything on that website, getting more and more
freaked out.
Yeah. This is when I could tell that something was seriously bothering him. So I let him, you know, have his space for a few days, trying to let him tell me what was going on. I had a pretty good idea what was going on, but I needed him to voice it. I didn't need to come out and say, you know, hey. So like any good wife, after 3 days, I cornered him at 1 a.m. Best time to, you know, have these deep conversations.
Probably with work the next day.
Of course.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. And so at that point, he just blurted out, I don't believe anymore.
Wow.
What had happened, to back up a little bit, when I found the New Order Mormon website, I had a ridiculously overloaded shelf at that point. I mean, I had everything on it, and then Prop 8 was everything times two on top of everything else. So it was crazy. Finding that page and finding out that it wasn't me just blew everything over all at once. I mean, within minutes of reading on that forum, finding out that there were hundreds or thousands of other people out there, all of whom had the same or similar issues that I did with all the different things that I did, finding out that there was all this other stuff that I didn't even know about at that point, because at that point I was extremely ignorant of the majority of the historical and doctrinal issues. But just finding out that there were other people out there blew my house of cards over all at once. So from there, I ended up over on Post Mormon and Zarahemla City Limits and Mormon Think and a couple of others. I got no work done for 3 days.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't look at this stuff at home. I was scared to death.
It's religious porn.
it really was. I really felt like I was sneaking around on my wife looking at porn because I was scared to death that I was going to get caught. And I was actually writing up a very long post one night before I had talked to her. And she was literally 5 feet from me on the couch asleep. And I was just finishing it up. And she wakes up and goes, "What are you, writing a novel?" Big pregnant pause. Yeah. I just kind of joked and hit send and closed the window and... So if you go back and read my first frenetic posts during that 3 day period, the fear. I was just actually reading them again the other day when I was looking for the links for you, and it really affected me. I mean, on a very deep level, to go back and relive those emotions that I was going through at that point, because at that point, I was 99% certain that when this came out, our marriage was done and I was going to be a part-time dad and it was just over. I could see the fairy tale burning to the ground when I closed my eyes.
And Nam's very supportive, but Nam also has a number of people on there who are living witnesses to the fairy tale burning to the ground.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that's what scared the crap out of me.
Right.
Is because I was reading firsthand accounts of people who've been through exactly what I'm going through right now. Right. And it all went to hell for them. Now, on the other hand, I had read a number of stories from people for whom it had worked out.
Yeah.
And that was what I was holding on to.
Right.
I couldn't quite make myself believe that it was going to work out like that, though. And so I couldn't bring myself to actually talk to her. And, you know, the mantra at NAM is go slow, go slow. And when they say go slow, they're talking about years.
Years.
I'm not a patient person.
Yeah, man, you and me both.
When
I'd already been going for years.
you know, when I do something, I kind of tend to dive in head first and then check how deep it is later. So I don't know how long it would have been if she hadn't kind of wrangled it out of me, but she knew something was going on. I'm not terribly good at hiding, especially when I'm freaking out on that level.
What's your screen name at NOM so people could go back and...
Tannis.
And I'm Tannis's wife.
Tannis's wife.
I figured the story had been told, so there I might as well piggyback on.
All right. So, Stacey, how did you react to all of that?
I was actually a little bit relieved because I had hit my breaking point and I was done. I couldn't do the church thing anymore. So when he said that he didn't believe anymore, I just hugged him and said, I don't either.
Huh.
That night is etched in my memory.
You talk about the memories that you will take with you to your grave, and that's one of them. Because if there's any aspect of my life that's a fairy tale, it was that night. I remember... I'm with the whole conversation was breaking all of the... If there are any rules for disengagement, I broke them by not taking my time and just blurting it out. But I started the conversation talking about, you know, all those goofy rom-com movies where the two leads that are supposed to get together in the end have some horrible secret that they're keeping from each other that, you know, they just know that if that ever comes out, that'll ruin everything. And then at the end of the movie, it comes out and it's not that big of a deal. And they laugh and they walk off into the sunset together. And that's basically what I talked about. I said, I really hope that that's what happens tonight. But I can't quite bring myself to believe it because we had talked over the years about different things that bothered us about the church, but they always went away. I remember probably 10 years before this happened, stumbling across the connection between Masonry and the temple ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember talking to her about it. And then I remember it just kind of going away.
Well, because I fixed it in my head that, you know, if it was something that came from the early days, then of course somebody else would have adopted it.
Yeah.
So
it was just stuff like that. I mean, we'd never really talked in depth about anything, but we had mentioned things that we'd had issues with over the years. And so I could almost make myself believe that it was going to work out, but I was so scared. And then I just blurted it out. I said, I can't do this anymore. I just don't believe it. I sit in church and I just don't believe any of it. It doesn't work for me. And I'm not connected to it anymore and I don't believe it. And she said she didn't either. And she had all the same issues that I did. And
the church does a very good job of making you feel alone and feel like you can't talk to your spouse or your family about your issues.
And they're all your issues.
Yeah. Makes you feel like you're the only one that has the problem. You're the only one that, you know, in this entire world, you can't be the only one that has that one issue. There's got to be somebody else that has the same issue as you.
It's hard to convince your brain of that always.
It is.
Very.
It is.
Yeah.
Especially when there's so much to lose.
So you were trying to convince him not to read his iPhone at church, but you say you had come up against your own breaking point. What was that?
Prop 8 was a big one for me, too. And really, I was in primary at the time, and I had a really hard time. I would sit there, and they'd have their little lessons and their music time. And it just occurred to me that this is brainwashing. You know, the way that they have the kids repeat the same things and do these little actions on everything and follow the prophet, you know, the little chant, follow the prophet, follow the prophet. I had a really hard time with the way that they were teaching the kids. They weren't teaching them to think for themselves. They were teaching them to regurgitate. They were basically trying to fit them into these boxes. And so I had a really hard time with that because my kids have always, we taught them how to be critical thinkers, which has kind of backfired now that they're teenagers. But
it probably won't backfire forever.
I hope not.
We both really had issues with the whole concept of trying to fit into the Mormon mold. Neither one of us really fit. And
we tried.
We tried. We really tried. But we just didn't fit in the mold. We only had two children, and we got flack for that from every corner.
And I wanted to do more than just be a mom. You know, yeah. I wanted to have a career. I've had a couple businesses there's things I've wanted to do that didn't fit into just being the mom thing. And I couldn't make myself just do that. Hmm. You can only clean the toilet so many times.
So you guys had this Disney moment and everything came together and you realized you weren't going to get a divorce. And then there's the what now? You live next door to Sean's parents.
Yes.
In Orem.
Yeah. Well, the biggest thing was talking to our kids.
Okay. How did that happen?
We actually took a weekend and went to Salt Lake. We got a hotel room. And we had some activities planned, and we sat down with the kids and said, you know, your dad and I have decided we're not going to church anymore. We don't believe it's true, but we'll let you guys decide what you want to do. The boy was 11, mm-hmm. and the girl was 15. And our son, the only thing he wanted to know is, are we still going to do things as a family? That was his only concern.
He was really concerned about it, too. Like, almost to the point of tears. Was very worried that now that we're not going to church, we're not going to do stuff as a family
or we won't anymore. Be a family anymore.
Which really bugged me at the time, because he's gotten this idea in his head that you can only be a family if you're in the church. Which...
they teach it.
Yeah, on one level or another.
Yeah. But once we, you know, let him know that that wasn't, that we were still going to be a family and we'd actually have more time to do activities, he was okay with that. He's like, oh, cool. The girl, on the other hand, took her a little bit longer because she was in the young women's program at the time and very heavily involved in it. So she actually decided she was going to keep going. But she only went 1 week after that to an actual Sunday service, called me halfway through and had me come get her. She said that she couldn't deal with it because people were just being weird to her.
Wow.
And then she was still doing the young women's activities during the week for a while.
And seminary.
Yeah, and seminary. Yes, seminary. And then she went sporadically because she'd only go to the fun activities. And then they started, you know, clamping down on, you can't really have fun activities anymore. They all have to have a religious purpose. So she kind of quit going. She went to camp 2010. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. 2010 was the last year she went to camp. She came home from camp and said two things to us. She said, they've ruined the Wizard of Oz for me.
Because that was the camp theme. And they tried to shoehorn religiosity into the Wizard of Oz theme and wrecked the movie for her, apparently.
And she said, I'm done with the church and I'm ready to send the resignation letter in. So,
So that was in summer of 2010. And when did you have your sort of epiphany moment?
It was the middle of August of 2009.
So 1 year, mm-hmm. 1 year later.
Yeah.
And okay. And what was happening with your extended families?
Mine's not in the picture.
Okay.
So they were kind of a non-issue anyway.
The few members of her family that we have anything to do with are either, well, I hate to use labels, but they're either Jack Mormons or they're never Mormons. So it really wasn't an issue. The biggest reaction we got from them was you.
Well, yeah, because they were, the ones that were Jack Mormons were expecting us to be able to pull them into the celestial kingdom with us. They weren't quite figuring how it
worked. So they were disappointed.
little bit?
Sarcastically.
You were the golden ticket.
Yes, it was kind of sarcastically disappointed.
And yet they haven't started going, so I don't know.
My family, on the other hand, well, it depends on who you're talking about. My Presbyterian grandparents, because my mother was a convert, and my evangelical aunt, her sister, were both, they were all quite thrilled.
See, they're probably not so dramatically upset.
No. They were very happy. We chose the least bad of all the bad methods for telling your family that you're leaving the church, because there aren't any good methods. For various reasons that aren't worth getting into, we sent an email out to everybody all at once so that we could just say our piece, have them mull it over, and then we could talk about it later. My brother and his wife have yet to say word one to us about the event.
No, they're talking to us still. They're still.
No, they're very friendly with us. You know, our relationship really hasn't changed significantly with them. But they haven't said anything to us about the fact that we've left the church. My sister came over a couple of days later to indicate that, you know, she didn't agree with our choice, but it was going to be okay. You know, that she would try to not let it affect our relationship. My parents didn't say anything for 5 days and then called us up and said, come over and talk to us about this. Because in the email that we sent out, we didn't mention any specifics. We didn't want to get into details of whys and wherefores. So we went over, and there was much wailing and gnashing of teeth and tears and testimony bearing. And we found out at that point that they had forwarded our email to the state president, who lives down the street.
Which we'd asked them specifically not to do, because we were going to take our time, because we saw two teenagers that were going to church and living in the area, and we were trying to make sure life was not going to be stressful on the kids.
We were trying to minimize the social impact. We wanted to tell who we wanted to tell in the method that we wanted to tell it. Well, cat's out of the bag now. So we communicated with the bishop and said, this is the situation, and we have said to our children that they can make the choice as to how they're going to deal with this and what their involvement in the church is going to be. We asked them to not harangue our children and ask them, you know, do you want to ride to church? You know, call them up and try to get them that way. And we said, if they want to go to church, they'll tell us and we'll take them. And to their credit, the stake president and the bishop and the local leadership in general were amazingly respectful, mm-hmm. of the boundaries that we had set. I was very pleasantly surprised, given the stories that I had read up to that point about people who had just been...
Well, the bishop made the comment that he was glad that, you know, even though he didn't approve of the journey we were taking, that we were taking it together. So he was at least, you know, aware and trying to be as supportive as he could.
Hey, given, you know,
the situation. Yeah, hey. It was a very pleasantly surprising response.
Yeah. Props where we can. And sure. It sounds like, really, so your sister that came over and said, I'm, you know, let's try to not have this affect our relationship, has that more or less stayed true?
Yeah.
More or less hasn't affected.
I mean, it's difficult for them, obviously. And there have been some bumps, but overall it's been very good.
Is it the elephant in the room? It's just
definitely.
There, right?
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah, there's part of me that wants to kiss that elephant. Really? I mean, that we have evolved to the point where we can have something that we disagree about as humans, mm-hmm. and decide to just let it be there. There's something pretty nice about that, because the alternative is to fight.
Well,
it,
to
right?
a certain extent. Unfortunately, I'm trying to remember when it happened. It was about 2 years
after we came out to my family, when, you know, I was just starting to decide that things were in a good place. My parents seemed to be comfortable talking about their lives in the church with us, which I fully expect them and want them to be able to do.
Well, that's their life. Yeah,
I want them to be comfortable. I mean, it's part of their life, like she said. And I don't want them to feel like they can't. And that seemed to be the case. And then that elephant in the room did what elephants seem to do. That they have zookeepers to follow them around to clean up after. He did it right in the middle of the room. If he had just sat quietly in the corner and kept sitting quietly in the corner, it would have been fine. But so about 2 years after we came out, my dad decided that 8 o'clock in the morning, just before I was supposed to go to work and just before he was supposed to get on a plane to go to California on a vacation, was the time to bear testimony again.
Under false pretense.
It got me over to their house, which, like you said, is next door.
Well, at least it wasn't a long drive.
Yeah. and just proceeded to, you know, become very emotional and ask me over and over again. He said, I don't understand. I don't understand how you could be in the place that you were and be so strong and be where you are now. I don't understand how it's possible. And I said, yeah, I know. I mean, at that point, I really felt for him. I said, I know you can't understand because I've been where you are now, but you haven't been where I am. And unfortunately, at that point, his kind of bishopness, because he'd been a bishop for a long time, and the church trains men that they always have some sort of patriarchal responsibility, even after their children have children of their own, they feel responsible. And so that kicked in, and he started to act like he had been where I am now. And I said, no. I just stopped him. I said, no, you haven't been. Because if you had been where I am now, you would be where I am now. You may have started down that road, but you decided for whatever reason to stop looking and stop learning and stop researching. And it got, I was trying to keep it civil, and I was trying to keep it outside of the discussion of historicity and doctrinal issues and all that stuff. I said, let's not, you know, let's just keep this, you know, I'd like to keep our relationship good. Let's not do this. But he didn't want to listen. And so it got less than pleasant. And he started bringing up apologetics, and I finally just had to shut it down. I said, look, this is not a road you want to go down with me. Let's just call it good. You know, I love you, and I want to have a good relationship with you, and I don't think we can do that if we're going to have discussions like this.
Hmm. So was that last year?
Yes.
That would have been
2011, yeah.
Yes, about a year ago, actually, ish. And it hasn't come up again since then.
Yeah, and
do you feel like it's a ticking time bomb, kind of? Like, every once in a while, you're just going to have this bomb just blow up all over you or something?
It's always there.
Yeah.
Honestly,
it is always there.
I don't know. I hope it doesn't, but I don't know. Because I know that they're hopelessly worried about us. And
the church has taught them, and they say even in the talks, like the conference talks that have come out, the parents are still responsible for their married children. So they're still being taught and being, you know, have all this stuff thrown at them, all this guilt that if their children are wayward, even if they're married, it's their responsibility to get them back.
Sure.
So, of course, they've got that pressure.
I told my dad at the time, I can't remember. We had a couple of talks right there at the beginning. I told my dad at the time, I said, if there's a loving God,
I don't believe that he would keep good people away from each other in the eternities, if there is such a thing. Because at that point I was well on my way to becoming an agnostic. And he actually seemed to be quite relieved to hear me say that. And I'm not sure all the thought processes that went on in his head at that point. But, you know, even as an agnostic atheist at this point, I still believe that. I still believe that if there's a loving God, and if there's any sort of eternity after this, that he would not keep us apart. It's the thought just kind of makes me stop that, you know.
'Cause he would be such a jerk.
Yeah. You'd have to be. You'd have to be. So, I don't know. It's entirely possible, knowing my family, that you know, this is something that's going to blow up in our faces again.
Well,
because they, like Stacy said, they constantly get guilted about wayward children.
Yeah.
No matter how old they are.
But we did have just have dinner with them on Sunday, and it was
good.
It was good.
It was really good.
There wasn't a lot of stress, and, you know, they did their prayer and everything, and but the religious talk was at a minimum, and we didn't get.
Yeah. Sometimes the elephant seems a little smaller.
Yeah. So what else in your life? Like, what changed as you made that transition? You stopped going to Elders Quorum activities and stopped having a calling. At some point, the garments came off, and
yeah,
that took
all hell took broke time. Loose, and it was Orgy City at the Levitt's house from then on out.
You'd think that, wouldn't
you? You'd think that. You'd like that, wouldn't you?
Well, let's see. We found a group called Calm.
Mm-hmm.
And we started, Dennis and Susan Borg were running it at the time.
Calm stands for those of you who don't know, Community After Leaving Mormonism. And there are groups pretty much everywhere. So if you're looking for a community, that's a good place to start.
Although, ironically, there's not a very good group in Salt Lake.
Which seems very strange to me. They're trying.
Anyway,
they're apparently working on getting it going.
Okay, anyway.
They've been talking to us.
So you found Calm.
Well, we went to that for...
We started going in October of 2009.
Yeah.
So a few months after everything crashed.
And then I can't remember, we've taken over for the last year or so.
Dennis and Susan Borg, who are awesome, awesome people. I mean, they've done more for us than I can possibly articulate. They were the ones that were in charge of Calm at that point, and we were going over to their house for probably a year-ish. Yeah. They had been running it for several years at that point. And then family issues got to the point for them where they felt like they didn't have enough time to devote to it anymore. And so now we are in charge of Calm for Utah Valley. And so we have meetings every month. And Calm is an interesting thing, because it's a great way to replace the social life that you lose when you leave the church, the community. Anybody who has left the church knows that your community is your ward.
Yeah, it's in your entire life, because that's who you do your activities with. That's who you see on Sunday. I mean, it just, your
and
whole life
so,
is wrapped up in it.
So being able to meet with people every month and talk about the things that are building up the pressure every month for you, talk about the issues that you're dealing with, talk about the things that you're trying to process. But more than that, just meet people and start to build new friendships and new social circles is huge. And so people will come out to Calm, and it's really awesome to watch them grow and process and get through these things and move on. And that's one of the difficult things about Calm. You say that there's not really much of anything going in Salt Lake, and it because it's tough to keep it going, because once you've processed through and you've built your new social life, you really don't need it anymore. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of stop going, and it happens gradually. But you just kind of move on with your life. And it's really great to see, but you've got to have somebody that's willing to take the reins and stick around. We've gotten past the point where we need it anymore, but we're still doing it because there are lots of people coming in new every month. We had 8 new people just last week.
Mm-hmm. And 6 the month before.
Yeah, 6 the month before. We usually have 20 to 30, maybe 35 people a month show up. And they're in various stages of walking wounded, I refer to them, because some people get out like us and they're just the luckiest people in the world. And I'm fully aware of how lucky we were. We got out with our entire family intact and no real issues. Some people
going through divorces right now because of it.
Yep. I know.
Spouses who will just, you express these doubts and they just bail.
Yep.
They take the kids and they just leave. And they're really hurting and they really need people to talk to. And that's why we keep doing it. I mean, we've met so many people in the last couple of years that we will count as the most amazing friends that we've ever had for life. Since we left the church, we've met the most incredible people. And
real people. They're not just facades and they're not just the assigned friends. And it's kind of nice when you can meet somebody for the first, when they're just learning to be themselves for the first time, when they're not having to hide behind what they're supposed to do, when they can be who they want to be and who they should be. It's kind of amazing to see them coming out of that and get to know them like that.
Or to watch them constructing who they are for the first time.
Yeah.
Because when everything collapsed for me, it was terrifying. I looked around me and I've described it as, you know, I spent my entire life living in this comfortable little cottage and somebody came along and blew it up. And I'm standing out in the middle of this gigantic open nothingness with the shards of my life laying around me. And now I have to pick every single one of them up and figure out what works, what doesn't, whether I believe this because I've been taught to believe it or believe it because it works for me. And, you know, part of that processing that people are doing when they come to the meetings is trying to figure all that out. And it really helps when you can talk to people that have been through the same process.
Or just say it out loud.
Yeah.
Because you don't have a social circle or family that you can even talk to. Just being able to voice that out loud and meet people in real life is huge.
Yeah, it is. It is.
So it's been a really incredible couple of years for us.
So what do you think the future holds?
Well, that's an open question. I honestly don't know.
And you know, I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
I'm okay with not knowing. It's kind of nice to have our lives open for us so we can make decisions as we go.
Yeah.
I mean, we're working on, I mean, our relationship with each other and our relationships with our kids are better than they've ever been before. Because now there's no secrets and there's no wedges. We can talk about anything. We can be ourselves. And we've always encouraged our kids to be themselves, but now we can really encourage them to be themselves. We've always told our kids, you know, you can be whatever you want to be. We never told our daughter that, you know, her big goal in life was to grow up and get married to an RM and start popping out babies. But now, anything. Everything is a possibility. And so we're working on continuing to build our relationship and our relationships with our kids. And we're still working on processing through some of the baggage and emotional issues that, speaking for myself, I wasn't even really aware of. I mean, things are still cropping up for me, and I think for you too.
Yeah.
Even now. things that are still affecting us on an unconscious level, you know, issues with sexuality and just personal image issues and self-worth issues and guilt that, you know, is just layered up over the years for, you know, any number of different things.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we're still working through all of that. And I mean, you know, you want to talk about it in terms of fairy tales, there's no such thing, but on another level, you know, I still feel like I'm living in a fairy tale because this has worked out beyond my wildest dreams.
Sure.
And so I'm still working on that happily ever after, I guess, to be completely corny.
Well, when you're in the church, there's you're in a perpetual state of like arrested development. You don't progress past where you need to because, you know, your path is laid out for you. You don't have to make any big decisions on your own, really, because how you live your life, what you do is all there for you. So we're still trying to figure out who we are. We're a little old to be doing that, but we're still doing it.
That seems fair. Well, I sure appreciate you talking and giving your story and your perspectives, and appreciate your friendship and appreciate the things that you do for people like me as they are trying to figure out who they are and where they are after all of a sudden everything changed. Yeah. So,
well, we had so many people help us on our way. We're just paying it forward now.
Fantastic. Well, thank you both. And
thank you.
We'll look forward to the years ahead.
Definitely.
The host for today's episode of Mormon Expression Voices was Greg Rockwell. Directing, producing, and editing was done by Heather C. And the theme music was provided by McCall Erickson. Thank you for listening. Mormon Expression Voices is a production of the Whitefields Educational Foundation. Find us on the web at whitefieldseducational.org. The Mormon Expression and Mormon Expression Voices podcasts, as well as other educational initiatives, are made possible by your generous donations. Please consider a subscription today. I'm feeling beautiful as I make no excuse now.